Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 828. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, just north of Chicago, and I'm happy to be back today. We've got a great episode lined up. I'm very excited to speak with a new acquaintance we have with us on the program, Dr. Edward B. Davis, who is the Professor Emeritus of the History of Science at Messiah University. Welcome, Ted. It's great to see you. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed meeting you at that small conference, and I'm really happy that you're interested in otherwise a kind of abstract subject that of an historian who's interested in lots of things about the history of science and Christianity, but specifically Robert Boyle more than anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to be speaking about all sorts of fun stuff today. Just to give our listeners and viewers a little bit of a background, as Ted mentioned, we did meet at a small conference just a few weeks ago. It was the Presbyterian Scholars Conference. We've spoken about that on the program, gave a little bit of a preview, and we even spoke with Jeff McDonald, the organizer of that conference. He was on a few weeks ago to talk about some Presbyterian history. But going down there, it's always nice to meet people. I've been, 3 years in a row now, and have seen similar and familiar faces each year, but there's always people I haven't met, and I was glad for you to be there. And you gave a wonderful presentation on the history of science, looking at it and how it intersects with Christianity. And then following up with your CV and looking at your works, I see that you've been at this for a long, long time. I was wondering if you might provide just a little bit of a sketch about just the nature of your work, because I'm absolutely certain there are many people that are watching this that are longtime viewers or listeners to Christ the Center, who also are very much students of science and interested in the intersection between science and faith. And they're going to love to hear about your particular scholarship.
Sure. I developed this particular interest of mine, both in the history of science broadly and in the history of Christianity and science more specifically. When I was both in my college years, but then more importantly in my early 20s after I graduated, I had been trained originally in physics with a strong interest in astrophysics. But I determined partway through my college career that my personal interests were changing, that I was actually much more interested in the humanities than I had understood before. And I probably would not spend a career in science. So I did teach high school science and mathematics for a few years before making a decision to go to graduate school to study the history and philosophy of science, with an emphasis in my case on the history of science and Christianity. That was an unusual route in those days. So people weren't doing it.
I know this is a well-developed field, the history of science, but some people, they don't typically think that way. They think of science and history as two different disciplines, but history covers the history of all sorts of things, especially the development of thought. There could be a history of philosophy. There could be history of mathematics. When we're looking at these things, we're looking at the development of the people and the ideas and the contexts of that surrounding the production of this intellectual output. Can you introduce people maybe who are unfamiliar or at least haven't thought about the history of science in terms of the nature of the field and the kinds of things that are explored?
Sure. I think you chose a couple pertinent examples there, Camden, where you mentioned history of mathematics and history of philosophy. Now, they're, again, more esoteric than sure. many of your listeners would be into, but people are trained in seminary. They've probably taken the history of theology.
Absolutely.
That's a similar thing. And if not, they might be more familiar with something like art history or music history or even economic history, these kinds of things. So it's a history of a discipline. In the case of the history of science, it's a history of related disciplines that are studying nature, you know, biology, chemistry, physics, astronomy, geology, you fill in the blank. But that would be the type of thing. So these are historical in their methodology, meaning that people don't use scientific methods, laboratory methods, for example, or observational methods in order to learn about these things. For the most part, I'll say for the most part. There's a few exceptions. Mm-hmm. One of the more interesting exceptions is the history of alchemy. I have a friend who's very seriously interested in that. He's a trained organic chemist and an historian.
Let me know when he figures it out. Let me know before anyone else.
He tries to reproduce classical alchemical experiments in his own lab to see what we could learn from that. But that's an exception. Ordinarily, historians of science are the materials we're using are humanities materials. For example, letters and scientific papers and opinion pieces and biographical information, printed and unpublished sources of various kinds, the same kinds of sources that a church historian would be using, or a political historian, or someone expert in the Civil War would be using. Mm-hmm. So the methods are those of the humanities, those of history. And the questions being asked are historical questions. So, you know, we're not asking scientific questions as we're doing history of science. We're asking historical questions about science and the scientists who created it.
Perfect. So just to provide an example, today we're going to be speaking a bit about Robert Boyle, who's a 17th century chemist, often considered the father of modern chemistry, a huge figure. If anyone's taken chemistry course in high school, even, you probably heard of Boyle's law and the relationship between the volume and the pressure of a gas. That's a layman's way of putting it. But we've heard about that. So instead of studying perhaps the volume of a gas per se and studying those things as they are, you're studying how did he discover this, or how did this idea or these principles come about? What came before? What came after? How did he do the experiment? All sorts of other things, which is involving the study of chemistry, but looking at it in terms of how it developed in its in time and in history. It's an interesting discipline, and I'd imagine that a lot of people would be really quite interested in this subject matter. How did you then, in, as you were getting, was it early on in your studies of the history of science that you really started to consider things from the perspective of the Christian worldview or Christian faith and seeing how these questions intersected? Or was that later in your studies that you wanted to maybe take a shift and start looking at those questions more specifically?
Well, in fact, it's the other way around. I became interested in the history of in Christianity and science before I made the decision to study the history and philosophy of science.
While you were teaching science, even, or studying it early on? Okay, wonderful.
Primarily while I was teaching high school science and mathematics for a few years, that I thought about these questions pretty deeply and decided I wanted, both for my own personal interest and also for the possibility that I might end up doing something different, teaching at a higher level, different subjects than in high school, that I decided to go to graduate school. So the graduate school decision was based on my developing interest in Christianity and science. I was teaching at a small Christian high school in North Philadelphia. At the time I made this decision.
What was the school? Because I lived not in North Philly, but I lived in a northern neighborhood of the city of Philadelphia. I lived in Mount Airy for a few years. But where was the school?
Interesting. My grandmother had a house in Mount Airy.
Loved it there. Yeah.
So the school was then called Cedar Grove Academy.
Okay.
It still exists. It's been reorganized once or twice. It has a different name today. But and a different location. They moved a few years ago. Maybe a mile or so further east than they had been located before. They used to be right near Olney High School, if you know where that is.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I've got a friend who's a pastor down there. We've also long been involved, and lots of our listeners would be well familiar with the Philmont Christian Academy in the Philadelphia northern area. That was co-founded by Cornelius Van Til, and also involved a lot of the volunteer support of the professors at Westminster Seminary back in the 40s and 50s, especially. So that has a rich history that intersects with my ecclesiastical kind of connections.
The school I taught at was in the same athletic conference as Philmont.
Your rivals.
Right. And Delaware County Christian School out in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. There were half a dozen small Christian high schools that competed against each other in a few sports.
Yeah.
So that's where my interest developed. When I would I attended some conferences intended for teachers at such schools, and began to network with people in other schools. And there was a teacher. His name, some perhaps might recognize his name, most won't. He's not nationally famous, but the late Frank Roberts, who was who had a seminary degree and a PhD in geology, and he taught at Delaware County Christian School. And he introduced me to an organization called the American Scientific Affiliation, which became, professionally speaking, the most important organization in my career. I've been a member of the ASA since the 1970s, when he introduced me to it. And through that, it's the oldest organization of Christian scientists in North America. Mm. And so it's through that that I met some very, very famous people. In fact, I've met through that on a personal basis. I mean, an example that everyone would recognize is Francis Collins. I've known Francis Collins for more than 20 years, and it's through that group and several Nobel laureates and a bunch of others. I'm not going to run down a list of other people, because Francis would be the most nationally prominent person. Ordinary people would recognize his name, but there's many, many other scientists of real standing in the field that I met through the American Scientific Affiliation. I also met some scholars in other fields, in theology and in history and biblical studies through that work. But it's mostly a network of people in sciences. And through that network, my interest developed especially in Christianity and science. More than any other area study. And it's from that I then jumped into the history of science for graduate school. So see, I wanted to end up where I ended up. This is one of those cases that does happen to people sometimes, where the end game I had planned out is what happened in God's providence. I don't know. But
amen.
Where I wanted to end up teaching Christianity and science and the history of science at college level in order to be helpful to young people. And so I planned a route that might get me there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've studied not the history of science per se, but in my philosophy courses and apologetics courses, I'm trained as a systematic theologian. And my particular department in my PhD program was called Historical and Theological Studies. So we had a focus in systematics, but it had a heavy dose of historical theology and just church history. In our discipline, we distinguish those two. They're slightly different. And then also apologetics. So you've read various things like Karl Popper and other key articles that are looking at kind of the underpinnings of epistemology, how we know what we know, what we can know through the senses, all these types of things. I would hope that many Christian scientists, and that's a bad way to put it, because that might evoke the Church of Christ scientists, but I'm talking about scientists who are Christians, who profess faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and the triune God. I hope that they would have a much more holistic and integrated view of knowledge and worldview and awareness. And the reason that they're pursuing their scientific studies is to glorify God and to explore his creation. But I find that at least with some secular scientists, some of them, at least some that I've had conversation with, and maybe this is a caricature or just anecdotal, but many of them, might not even give much thought to epistemology or the undercurrents or the foundations of their knowledge. They'll sometimes treat their scientific inquiry as either self-evident or, somehow separated from religion, faith, or all these other types of philosophical questions about knowledge. They just, I'm just a scientist. I just follow the data without ever going any deeper into what are the data? What is the nature of cause and effect? How do we know what we know? All these types of things. Do you find that as you're so much in the sphere of studying the intersection between the history of science and Christianity, that are there more people in the secular world that are asking these questions, or do you find that they typically try to avoid them? I'm curious just what your assessment is of the atmosphere here of thought in the secular scientific community.
Well, I can only speak anecdotally on that.
Sure.
I don't have a data set to draw on, but my impressions would be similar to yours in some respects. For example, I do think it is so that a large number of working scientists don't think formally about philosophy of science or relationship between science and other types of knowledge. In other words, they don't ask what you accurately called epistemological questions about their work. However, in practice, they're pretty good reasoners.
Oh, sure. I don't doubt that they're finding results.
Yeah, and they're pretty good reasoners. They have excellent analytical abilities. So they practice good philosophical things. They just not might recognize what they're doing by formal names and say, I'm really doing a type of philosophy here. There are some outspoken scientists, famous scientists who dissed philosophy and its relevance to science. An example was the late Stephen Hawking. Another is a well-known astrophysicist, Lawrence Krauss. Both of those individuals were atheists. And in fact, Krauss describes himself as an anti-theist, and he disses what philosophers have to say about him. One of his claims, namely that we can, through something called quantum cosmology or quantum gravity, we can understand how the universe kind of created itself out of nothing without a creator. And he was criticized for saying this by another person who doesn't believe in God, a physicist at Columbia named David Albert. And Albert wrote a 5 or 6 paragraph review of this idea in the New York Times book review issues. And he basically said that Krauss has no idea what he's talking about, that he's really in deep philosophical territory here. And Krauss's response to him was to say, what do philosophers know? They don't know anything, this type of thing. So that's true that there are some scientists, including some prominent scientists, who don't think they give house room to philosophy. And yet so that means in practice, they're going to be doing philosophy poorly and not being aware of it. So that can be the case. But a lot of scientists that I speak with, not just through that ASA organization, but in other places, really are interested in historical and philosophical questions. And sometimes they're pretty well read on those things. They recognize they're not professional philosophers or they're not professional historians, and they want to listen to the people who are, but they do have that interest. They're aware of that the questions they're asking aren't strictly scientific. They're more philosophical or historical or even theological in nature, and they want to read good stuff by people who know what they're talking about in these areas.
Sure. I think one of the benefits too of becoming more aware and multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary, I don't mean everyone needs a PhD in everything in all of these disciplines, but being aware of what is being studied, trying to read widely, at least semi-popular products of all these different disciplines is helpful because it gets you out of your own head and out of your little silo of study. That's why I've been appreciating looking at your work as well. We're going to turn our attention soon to considering Robert Boyle, 17th century chemist. But I was reminded a little bit just reading some of this stuff. We tend to be very arrogant about our present knowledge. How do I put this? You tend to think, well, we live in the 21st century, and you read the scientific output of someone from the 17th century, and you say, these guys didn't know anything. And you realize, well, maybe in 300 years, the scientists of the future are going to say the same thing about us. And it helps, I guess, temper our attitude and give us more of a perspective in terms of where we are and how much we're reliant on the people that have come before us and how much more there is to know that we'll never plumb the depths of in the present age. Have you found that your study of the history of science has really broadened your perspective? And I don't know, given you much more an understanding of the scope of the knowledge that's out there and what we know and what we don't know?
For sure. One of the things that studying, I hope, any branch of history can give a person is a respect for the historical actors, the people in mm-hmm. your scope of study, and for what they did know, and what confronted them, what difficulties confronted them, and how they did the best they could in their circumstances, which is really all we can ask of ourselves too, isn't it? And so it's that type of thing. I mean, an example of this, you know, this modern, here's an example of the modern arrogance at work. In the post-Civil War years, in the second part of the 19th century, what many people refer to as the progressive era, in that particular period of time, it was commonplace for educated and other people, for, you know, highly educated people and lots of other people, to regard the people living in what historians call the Middle Ages as very ignorant and very backward. And popular mm-hmm. depictions of that period abound, even today in film, as well as over the years in many, many other works of art, paintings and such, and works of literature, where people are depicted as morons even, or idiots, because mm-hmm. they lived in the Middle Ages. The most famous example of this is a false story that was in middle school social science books right through the 20th century. Namely, the story that Columbus had to persuade stupid, ignorant people that the earth is round, and even had to persuade the king and queen of Spain that the earth is round so that they would invest in his voyage. Well, that's just a crazy story historically. We know, for example, that there's not I cannot tell you, and the experts I'm reading cannot tell me of a single educated European that is a university educated person of the 15th century, that's Columbus's time, who they cannot identify a single educated author of the 15th century who didn't know the earth is round. And many of them also knew roughly how far around it is, because that number has been available since before the time of Christ. The size and shape of the earth have been known since the ancient Greeks. And that knowledge never disappeared in Europe. So that's what people were taught at universities from the get-go. We know that. We have the university textbooks for even before the printing press of Gutenberg, when they were handwritten manuscripts. We know what people were taught in astronomy courses, and we know that European universities all taught astronomy as part of mathematics. And it's so anyone who's educated at a university was taught from the beginning of the course that the earth is round and here's roughly how big it is. So this myth that's been created in modern times about the ignorance of our medieval predecessors is just so widespread, even still today, though I think, as far as I can tell from an informal look at contemporary social studies books, I can't find it anymore. So I think it did disappear around the end of the 20th century in books. Yeah. So that's an example of this. But I've already given you an example of how smart the ancient people already were. By roughly 250 BC, people in the Hellenistic world, the world that was the legacy of Alexander, you know, the mm-hmm. North Africa, Middle East, Asia Minor, or then the Byzantine civilization later, this area of the world, where Greek was the language of scholarship, they all knew this, you know, and they had worked out that the earth is approximately the size that we think it is today. And this was all done hundreds of years before Jesus. So this is a pretty astonishing achievement. And in addition to that, they also knew very closely to the modern number the distance from the earth to the moon. They had figured that out. They had figured out it was 60 times the radius of the earth from here out to the moon. And that's still the modern value, is just about exactly 60 times the radius of the earth out to the moon. This is astonishing when you think about it. But these people had figured this out, and they had good solid reasons behind it.
Sure.
So, you know, when people say that there was no knowledge or science before the modern world, this is just silly. You know, it's long before Christ, the Greeks had figured out things like this. There was genuine science in the ancient world, even though in the modern world, a lot of times people will say, no, there wasn't.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Tell us about Robert Boyle then, sitting him in context, a 17th century guy. So where does, before we maybe get into the details of Boyle, can you describe where modern contemporary science at this time was? What was going on in the early 17th century before we're introduced here to Robert Boyle?
Well, many, many things were going on in the early 17th century. It would take half a dozen broadcasts to really lay that out nicely for people.
All right, well, let's schedule them.
Sure, if you want, we can come back.
Let's do it.
Relevant to Boyle's own situation, I would say that what was happening across Europe at that time, where the universities were, is that a lot of people were beginning to raise very serious questions about the accuracy and truth of the science that the Greeks had created. I've already indicated that the Greeks did have genuine science. They knew some things that we still think are true today, and they had really solid reasons for knowing them. But at the same time, the use of laboratory experiments was minimal prior to the early modern period, the period we're talking about. Prior to the 16th and 17th centuries, laboratory experiments were not unheard of, but they were used minimally. Laboratory experimentation really takes off explosively in the 16th and into the 17th century. And it's also the case that explorers are bringing back not evidence that the Earth is round, which, as I say, we've already known that forever, but that Aristotle and the Greeks were simply wrong. Aristotle and Claudius Ptolemy and the great Greek geographers and anthropology people were simply wrong about the nature of the planet in terms of where the land masses are and where people could live. You know, no one knew about the Western Hemisphere. No one in the Eastern Hemisphere knew about it, just as no one in the Western Hemisphere knew about the Eastern Hemisphere. We didn't know about each other as peoples until after Columbus. And at the same time, the explorers, especially the Portuguese explorers who went around Africa to get to the Far East, began to understand that the tropical regions of the Earth are heavily inhabited. And this is something that Aristotle didn't think was possible. You know, I'm a person who doesn't like humidity and really hot summer. I kind of sympathize with Aristotle when he says the torrid region, as they called it, the torrid region is uninhabitable. I think, well, he's right. It is uninhabitable, at least for
Sign me.
but in fact, of course, equatorial regions in South America, specifically, of course, on the eastern side, Brazil, which the Portuguese are becoming familiar with very quickly, and in Africa, on both the western and the eastern coasts of Africa, the equatorial regions are heavily populated. And so this is something that the Greeks would not have comprehended. They would have thought that wasn't true. And so people began to question whether the Greeks really did know it all or not. It wasn't so much whether they were stupid, but whether they had really known it all. And how much we're actually making progress, if you will, in our knowledge of the world. The sense that this is growing takes off in the 16th and 17th centuries. We're actually making intellectual progress. And we're knowing things the Greeks never knew. And we know them for good reasons. At the same time, all kinds of new instruments are being developed: telescopes, microscopes, barometers. Boyle doesn't invent the barometer, but he gives it its name. Devices like this, which are capable of telling us things that we could never know with the unaided senses. So the knowledge base for science expands tremendously during the 16th and 17th centuries. So it's a period that historians traditionally have called the scientific revolution, a term that is not entirely out of use, although it's been heavily criticized for various reasons that I won't go into here. It's a period that I still like to call the scientific revolution. So there's something happening to science. It's really becoming much more of a progressive enterprise with knowledge, and we have so many more ways of learning things than we used to, and we got to put the picture of the world back together again. So this is the period that Boyle grows up in and lives through and contributes to.
Yeah. Just for our listeners and viewers too, I think they'll be interested to know Boyle's dates are 1627 to 1691. He was a Anglo-Irish, a devout and a pious Anglican, obviously a Reformed, coming from the Reformed and Presbyterian tradition. You know, I subscribe to the Westminster Standards as a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And the Westminster Assembly was held between 1643 and 1653, which was the result of and part of the English Civil War, which they sought to restructure the Church of England. To my knowledge, Boyle had nothing to do with the assembly at all, but he certainly lived at the time. So I think people would be interested to know, because a lot of people might know about England and Ireland and Scotland and Wales in this time period, but they don't necessarily know about all the scientific developments and advancements, and know that in that same set of islands, we have, you know, the birth of modern chemistry. As Boyle was living here during the assembly, he would have been about 16 to 26 years old during that whole thing. Well, yeah. What are some details about Boyle's life beyond that? When did he become interested and introduced to science, and how did he finally end up studying chemistry?
Wow. Two very big questions. Let me point out that Robert Boyle was born into one of the wealthiest families in the whole English realm. His father, Richard Boyle, was named the first Earl of Cork in Ireland. He was a younger son in an English family, which means he wasn't going to inherit wealth, and so he went and created his own fortune in Ireland. As a colonialist, basically, in Ireland. And he was a publicly pious, but really an unscrupulous man who pursued power at all costs. Excuse me. Robert Boyle was the seventh son and 14th child of the second wife of the first Earl of Cork. Okay. And so he's pretty far down the ladder in terms of his status in the family. He's got all these older siblings, and their views are all over the map politically. During the English Civil War, he literally has relatives on both sides, and he himself is staying out of the London area in his estate that he's inherited from his really wealthy father, about a square mile of land down between Dorset and Somerset in modern England, a place called Stallbridge.
Okay.
But as a youth, he didn't know his parents very well. His mother died when he was just 3 or 4 years old, and his father sent him with an older brother on the grand tour to the continent to get his education. And his father died while Boyle was on the grand tour. So when he comes back as a teenager, he is already an orphan technically, but he's inherited a lot of land from his father. So he's independently wealthy, although his brothers and sisters are generally much wealthier than he is. He's independently wealthy, and he's able to pursue a career in whatever he wants to do. He develops a powerful sense of Christian vocation, in fact, from reading Altstädt, the German Reformed author who writes a huge encyclopedia, and Boyle gets a sense of vocation from Altstädt and from others. He has an Erasmian sense of ethics. And so he decides as a young person that looking around in his family, excuse me, and seeing all these playboys Some of his older brothers are just playboys, along with Charles II, even. They buddy up with Charles II and go around to the brothels and other places. Mm-hmm. And one of Boyle's sisters-in-law becomes a mistress to the king, in fact. And, you know, this is the brother he had gone to the continent with on the grand tour. His young wife gets essentially abandoned for several years as her husband is sent with Robert Boyle. Just a few days after their wedding, Francis and Robert are sent to the continent for several years. You know, and this older brother's just gotten married, and so when he comes to a woman from an influential family, in fact, and when, you know, when he comes back, and then he carries on his life, it's not surprising that she ends up as a mistress of Charles II. So this Boyle sees a lot of this kind of conduct among the men in his family, and he sees some of his sisters married to worthless characters. His favorite sister, Catherine or Kate, was married at 16 to a worthless rake, who was described once by a family friend as the only good thing you could say about him is that he seldom comes sober to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this type of thing. And so Boyle sees this licentiousness all around in his family. He himself resolves never to marry. He doesn't want to get involved in a similar situation himself. And he is deeply sensitive to really the mistreatment of women, the misogyny of what that's happening and he sees in his own family. And he thinks there's a better moral course, and that is to live for the common good, the common good. You know, there's an old phrase, the common wealth of learning, that's used by a lot of early modern scholars. Copernicus uses it. Many others use it. It's the common good. This is one of the things that unified otherwise divided populations of scholars like Catholics and Protestants, or among Protestants, was this common interest in learning and learning for the common good. So Boyle becomes extremely well known for this in his both in his private and public life. He becomes really a bulwark of personal piety and generosity. As far as I can tell from reading a lot of other people in the 17th century, the people who knew him knew this, and nobody questions it or raises problems about it. It really does seem as though in this regard, he's almost a saint. He's a person who's really, really living out the love of God for others through this experience. Now, he gets these attitudes before he gets interested in science.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. And how then does he eventually come to his scientific pursuits? Is it another avenue in which he feels there's opportunity to benefit the commonwealth of human understanding? This is a need for humanity. Is he just exploring all sorts of things and just stumbles upon it? I'm curious about his particular studies, or did he generally throughout his life maintain a wide breadth of pursuits? And just so happens he's known for chemistry.
Well, he did maintain a wide breadth of pursuits. He did. He had already written for his own circle of people unpublished works about theology, about piety, about vocation. He'd already written works like this, many works like this, some long works like this, and very prolix works like this before he becomes a scientist. So it's somewhere in his early 20s when he gets this love of experimental science, and it's in a context of laboratory chemistry. There's influences on him early on. He's involved with Samuel Hartlib's circle. This is a person who was a disciple of Comenius, the educational reformer from Eastern Europe. And Boyle may pick up some interest in chemistry from them. He may get a little of it from his sister, who's a kind of practical chemist, like many of the noble women were in the day, making chemical substances for their own families. He will later, in fact, do what John Wesley does many, many years later. He will publish a set of chemical recipes, or prescriptions, if you will, a large set of these. He first does it for a Puritan in New England. And distributes it privately, but then it's issued much more widely in England. So this is the kind of thing he becomes interested in. interestingly, a Bahamian, you could even say an American in that colonial sense, a man named George Starkey, who is an alchemist, becomes influential on Boyle early on. He kind of tutors Boyle in laboratory procedures and in basic chemical theory. And he learns a lot of chemical theory from reading Daniel Sennert, who is, you know, again, I think he's a continental author, but he's like almost other authors who want to be read. He's writing, he's publishing in Latin. And so Boyle's reading the theory of Daniel Sennert, that there are minimum particles, not necessarily indivisible like atoms, but there's minimal particles that are minimal size particles that are involved in chemical reactions and mixing and remixing in various forms. This becomes influential on him as a very young natural philosopher, as the term would have been used then, or chemist. Yeah. These interests take off when he moves to Oxford. He moves to Oxford in the 1650s to become involved with a group of natural philosophers there. Boyle himself never attended Oxford. In fact, he never attended university at all. He got his education, right? Really?
Just on the tour.
And he had had about a year and a half. He'd had about a year and a half at Eton, the famous private school there. But he never actually attended university at all, and he never had a university appointment. But he was wealthy enough to be self-educated. He could learn anything he wanted to do. He learned Hebrew, for example, partly by working with rabbis. We don't know who they were exactly, but he says this much. And he learned Greek. So he learned biblical languages well enough that he carried around those language Bibles to church and would compare the reading in the English in church with what he has in the original. So I wouldn't say he was a biblical scholar, not by modern standards, but he knew the biblical languages probably as well as most working pastors know biblical languages. He did this at the challenge of Archbishop James Usher, who was a close friend of his father. He basically challenged the young Boyle to learn these biblical languages and become a scholar of these things. But Robert's ultimate interests were elsewhere. They were in laboratory science.
We're very much familiar and appreciative of James Usher. It's interesting to see the connection there. I was wondering if there was the one specifically. So he's friends with his father. Did that carry on at all? I can't recall when Usher passed away, but if Richard Boyle, if I remember correctly, Robert's father passed away when Robert was on the grand tour in his teens. Right. Did he maintain any relationship with Usher after that?
Well, yes, because when Usher writes him and encourages him to do this, as I recall, I think it's in the early 1650s. I'd want to check that point if I were publishing an article. I'd want to check exactly when it was, you know, but it's somewhere along that time is when Archbishop Usher encourages Boyle to study the biblical languages. It may have been the late 1640s, but it's around the time he's either 20 or a little older or younger that Usher urges him to do this. And Boyle ends up writing a treatise called On the Style of the Holy Scriptures, which is trying to defend the Bible against the charge from various persons that it's basically, you know, if God wrote this book, it's not evident from the writing because it's not very well written. You know, this is not exactly a literary masterpiece that we have here. Yeah. God could have done a better job, if you will. And so Boyle wants to respond to that, and he does in this work on the Holy Scriptures. It is later published, one of his earliest published books, but it's written quite a few years before its publication. Mm-hmm. It was written during that period as a young man when he's kind of working out where he's going to be going.
Absolutely. You mentioned that Boyle was hanging around and learning from and interacting with natural philosophers. I would wonder if you could describe what that is, but I'm also interested to understand Boyle's views of the mechanical philosophy, of what that was, and how did he see the world? You mentioned some of the basic particles, you know, what we understand as molecules interacting and those sorts of things, but how did Boyle conceptualize the world? What did he think about it? And was that unique at the time, or was he kind of cutting edge?
Well, I would say that what he did as well as anyone of his day was to take those ideas about particles mm-hmm. in motion and try to work out how you could see this is true in so many areas. A nice example he gives is that of how a dog is able to follow a person from their scent. And he kind of works out that, you know, what it is these little particles of a person and their particular odors are coming off into
I'm
the
going
air.
Deer hunting this rest of this week. So this is on my mind. I got to get rid of my scents so these deer don't smell me.
And that the dog, by inhaling these little tiny microscopic particles that have been part of, you know, the surface of a human body somewhere, that the dog is able to follow you. This type of thing. He calls it corpuscularism. These little mm-hmm. corpuscles really means little bodies. And he names this, he is the first actually to use the term mechanical philosophy.
Really?
He coins that term in 1661, I believe. However, Henry Moore, the famous Platonist philosopher, had used the term mechanic philosophy, not mechanical, mechanic philosophy, just a couple of years earlier. So you could credit that term to Moore and Boyle, if you want, for introducing that term. The ideas are much older than that. The ideas go back to antiquity with the ancient atomists. The idea that, you know, nature is ultimately composed of indivisible particles of matter mm-hmm. that move around and recombine in various ways. In the ancient world, that idea gets associated with philosophical atheism.
Hmm. Sure.
The atomist philosophers deny that there's any design or purpose in the universe, and that everything in the universe, even the bodies of living things, are composed of these atoms that have moved around in an infinite empty space, a void, and have randomly collided with one another to form different concretions. That's the mm-hmm. atomist philosophy. And that scientific view then, the scientific piece of that about corpuscles moving around and forming things has to get, as it were, baptized before it can be used by Christian natural philosophers. And some people working ahead of Boyle, in advance of Boyle, do that, especially the French cleric, Pierre Gassendi. Who says basically that these corpuscles, these atoms, are created entities, that God has made the world through in this way, by making little particles of matter under his sovereignty, and he can cause them to move around and combine in various ways and give them various laws of behavior, if you will. The term laws mm-hmm. of nature is one that Boyle uses very, very often in his work. So
maybe it's reductionistic to call to ask the question this way, but would we see Boyle as a Calvinist, or did he have a highly developed understanding of God's sovereignty, of his works of creation and providence, even down to a molecular or atomist level, atomic level?
He does. Mm-hmm. In that respect, he sounds like a Calvinist. Mm-hmm. He would resonate with that. Boyle did have a lot of Calvinism in his training. Mm-hmm. His tutor on this grand tour was a Huguenot who had left France for Geneva, and he was a cousin by marriage of Jean Diodati, the very famous Reformation preacher. And Boyle went to church with him twice a week, and this Huguenot, whose name was Isaac Marcons, tutored both the boys in Calvin's catechism and also had them read scripture. So Boyle has this background. He knows Calvinist theology inside out, but there's no evidence that I am aware of, and a couple of other scholars have looked more closely into this than I have. There's no evidence I am aware of that he really would have identified as a Calvinist in terms of the confessions. And as you mentioned, he was an Anglican. But he himself was invested in these issues. He read deeply in contemporary theology. And he seems to have felt that somehow God's sovereignty and human freedom were in fact compatible at some level, although he could not work it out. He does not seem to, I cannot recall a place where he actually articulates a view of predestination, for example. And so he might not have been, strictly speaking, a Calvinist, depending on how you want to define it.
Sure.
But he certainly knew Reformed theology. He knew it, but a lot of elements of Reformed theology are not, you know, unique to the Reformed. For example,
exactly.
Yeah, for example, Boyle knew Augustine. And he even says at one point that if God were to withdraw his ordinary concourse, the creation or nature or the creation, I forget which term he uses, would lapse into its first nothing. That's how he puts it. And this, of course, is straight from Augustine. And so that type of thing. He certainly knew a lot of Calvinists in England. He knew some Puritans, including Richard Baxter. But he did not attend Puritan assemblies as he could have. As a person of wealth and independence, he could have had his own private chaplain if he wanted, and it could have been anyone he could have chosen. So he didn't do that. He was a faithful Anglican his whole life. The only time we know of when he attended a different religious assembly is when he went to hear a Quaker once, he made a commentary about this in one of his writings, where he disagreed with this particular person's view of the resurrection of the body. And so, you know, we're not aware anyway if he was involved with any assemblies that were not Anglican.
Sure. No, that's one. But very stark contrast between Boyle's views and maybe deism of the day and age, too.
Yes. Now, one can make a case, I think a fairly weak case, that Boyle was a deist because he used the clockwork metaphor all the time. And he spoke about how God had made this world like a clock, where he has these plans that once he establishes them, he puts them into nature, and this is how it works out because God has foreseen where all this is going. That really sounds like deism. On the other hand, at the same time, Boyle had many other expressions for nature, such the one I already referred to, when if God withdraws his ordinary concourse, the world lapses into its first nothing. Yeah. There's lots of other places where Boyle speaks in quite different ways. So I think this is a limited view of Boyle to see him as simply liking the clock metaphor and tending to deism. I see why later people might want to do that, and they might want to discard the part about God's transcend or God's sustenance and God's imminence in the world.
Sovereignty and providence.
God's imminence and do that. In my view, as an amateur theologian, what you have for Orthodox theology of creation is a plateau. And if you get on one side and fall off, you can fall off into deism by forgetting about God's imminence. And on the other side, you can fall off into pantheism by forgetting about God's transcendence. Yeah. And so you do
absolutely.
This is where Boyle lives. Boyle lives on the plateau of doing Orthodox theology. So
good place to be.
Yeah, so that's what I would say about that part. But he was concerned about these questions, though, these deep theological questions. He was very concerned about Socinianism, which he thought was unorthodox. He was very concerned about people believing that the world is something that God did not design, and he's concerned about people who think that God just leaves the world alone. Boyle believes in miracles happening every single day. For Boyle, the age of miracles was not over. It was a miracle when God united a soul with a body in embryo. That was a miracle, which Boyle thought probably happened.
Creationist.
Boyle thought it probably happened around quickening, which is the very traditional view on that. But this is an act of a miraculous act. This is something that transcends what nature can ordinarily do. That God takes a rational and spiritual soul and unites it with inert matter. And since persons are born every day, and persons are conceived every day, and persons go through quickening every day, this happens every day. So God is not done doing miracles in Boyle's view.
I like that. Let's talk real briefly in the time we have just to speak about some of Boyle's. You mentioned all sorts of things that he contributed to, even providing the name for the barometer and being involved in instrumentation and in these types of things. But perhaps the thing Boyle is most known for, at least name-wise, is Boyle's Law, but he didn't discover that, did he?
No, he didn't. And he doesn't say that he did. He doesn't claim priority.
He's had good
this.
Marketers. He's got a good branding, good PR firm.
It's sometime after his death that it becomes known as Boyle's Law, perhaps because of his status as a wealthy English gentleman, if you will.
Yeah.
He doesn't articulate this mathematically either, the way you would find it in a modern chemistry textbook, as you'd find it written as an inverse proportion. The idea is there. It is an inverse proportion, but he expresses it with a table of measured pressures and volumes. That's how he expressed it, is it in tabular form. So he does very precise experiments showing that a conjecture he's heard about from a couple of individuals he knows, and he names them. He credits them when he introduces this, and he says he's basically performed the experiment to see if it's true, and he thinks it is within the limits of his ability to test it. He doesn't even state it as a universal law in nature. He just says within my ability to test it with the equipment I have, this is true.
That's interesting to me, and perhaps this is a whole field of study, but just the idea of a universal law. Obviously, God can do what he wants according to his nature. He can manipulate the world any way he wants, but he does seem pleased to do things regularly and ordinarily, and there are things that we consider universal laws of nature. But I've always wondered, you know, in terms of how other people view that, especially people who are atheistic or agnostic of sorts. Did Boyle have, he wasn't calling this principle he's studying a universal law, but did he have an awareness, or did he ever use that language, or is that something more contemporary to us?
I'm not sure if he quite uses the term universal law.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks of natural laws all the time, either uses the term natural law or laws of nature. There's dozens of references to that in his work. He's not the first to speak this way. In fact, that term laws of nature goes way, way back in history.
Oh, sure.
I could even show it to you in the Latin form, lex naturae. The earliest instance I am aware of is in Ambrose's paraphrase of the hexameral treatises by Basil of Caesarea. And Basil has in Greek an equivalent of laws of nature. Now, this is 4th century. And so, now there's even earlier references in classical antiquity to a term like law of nature. So this is not a modern idea. But the notion that these are under God's sovereign control, that's very much part of Boyle's vocabulary, as it had been part of Pierre Gassendi's vocabulary, that this is the case. You know, God is in charge of these laws of nature. In fact, God, they're creations of his, if you will. They're subject to his sovereignty. They don't have to be the way they are. They could be otherwise. God could have chosen even not to send Christ to redeem us. You know, God can do what God wants to do. God is not bound to create human beings. God is radically free for Boyle, radically free.
So that's his voluntarism then.
That's right.
But is God free to, let me ask you this, a follow-up, because the listeners would like to know, is he such a voluntarist that God could change his own nature?
No.
Or is it he is radically free to do anything he wants according to his nature, I suppose?
He's radically free in the sphere of nature. In the sphere of history. He doesn't explore, that I could see, the question you asked about morality. The fundamental thing about God and his own nature, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he's so opposed to Socinianism too, that God isn't able to change himself, among other things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wonderful. But Boyle is influenced by what you've labeled the voluntarist current. That's something that gets talked about by a lot of modern scholars dealing with Boyle, including myself. I've used that language in describing Boyle's view of the laws of nature.
Yeah. Tell me about, we'll have to come back for round 2 or 3. I'd love that. But, for the sake of people being able to follow up, looking through your curriculum vitae, there's so many different articles on a wide variety of subjects, but many on Boyle. Is this a larger project that you're writing, a larger work on Boyle, or continuing to pursue his life and the history of science and Christianity through that lens?
Well, I did devote a large part of my scholarly output to Robert Boyle. And there's you don't want to hear the whole version, the long version of how that all came about. But I developed the interest in Boyle originally in my doctoral studies. I did write one chapter in my doctoral dissertation about Robert Boyle.
Yeah.
Another chapter was on Descartes, for example. Another chapter was on Newton. Oh, another chapter was on Galileo. Okay. But I did this thing on Boyle.
And I later got
connected with a British scholar who's still living, Michael Hunter. And Michael knows more about Robert Boyle than anyone who's lived since Boyle's day, undoubtedly. And he needed a collaborator to help identify what these manuscripts were in the Robert Boyle papers, which are at the Royal Society in London. And he thought that my knowledge of Boyle's published works was at least comparable to his, and he wanted someone who could help him with that. So I spent many, many weeks, months, going through the archive of Boyle's papers in London and helping Michael Hunter identify them. Now, this is in the days before PCs existed, that this all started. Well, PCs were just coming into use, personal computers like Apple's had just come out.
And I didn't far have from it. The internet and being no able internet. To scan things. And
right. There was no internet then. The word internet wasn't even invented until the 1990s. And there was no email. And, you know, this was all done by the database that was here. Okay. The database that was here was reading reading Robert Boyle's manuscripts and saying to myself or to Michael, this is published somewhere. And then I would use the tools I had available to me then to figure out where it was published and what was different between the manuscript and the published version, and therefore starting eliminating things that were left at the edge that were not published. Mm-hmm. And so, so I did a lot of that work with Michael Hunter, and that culminated in something we hadn't foreseen originally. It culminated in being approached by a publisher, a small publisher of luxury editions of British authors, Pickering and Chatto. They had done Dickens, Darwin, Mary Wollstonecraft, and now they come along and they want to do Boyle. And so we did Boyle. We did really the definitive edition of Robert Boyle, with all the information we gathered from the manuscripts is all poured into the editorial apparatus for that edition. So it's massive. It's 14 volumes. And two of the volumes are unpublished works of Boyle. That is previously unpublished works of Boyle that weren't published until the end of the 20th century by us. So that's the Boyle piece. I tried to stop working on Boyle soon after that and work and get back to other things, including American religion and science. But I've been badgered over the years to write this or that piece on Boyle. And so the thing you saw that was published in an open access journal this summer is just that. It's a piece that I was actually asked if I would consider writing by somebody else.
Yeah.
It wasn't my idea to write that. I proposed the topic to write about, but I didn't. The idea of writing another piece on Boyle wasn't really mine.
Well, I want to introduce, I think I've just discovered Davis's Law, which is the inverse proportionality between your interest and desire to write on Boyle and your scholarly output on Boyle. So,
well, I liked it at the time I was working on him, but, you know, I still like Boyle. But there's other things I'm interested in, too.
I get it. Before I let you go, what was in this? Really, I love hearing stories about this and study. And no doubt you ran into some surprising and interesting things, discovered some things about Boyle or his work that you didn't expect. Do you have any stories or any specific examples? What was the thing that perhaps surprised you the most in those pursuits?
Well, I've made some scholarly discoveries that for Boyle scholars would be, some would say, are important. But, you know, for real people, they're not very important.
I got you. I got you.
Actually, to be honest, the best discovery I had in this work was not related to Boyle. It was one day I was in the library of the Royal Society, which in those days was up on the second floor, which is a big deal because now it's in the basement. So this was a wonderful place to work. And the fellows of the Royal Society would occasionally come in. They had access to the building, free access. And one day a man comes through with a clerical collar. And I'm thinking, boy, there's not many Royal Society fellows who are ordained ministers. I wonder if this is John Polkinghorne.
Oh,
so
no
I walked up to him and said, pardon me, are you John Polkinghorne? It was. And that led to a long relationship I had with Polkinghorne. Phone calls and not emails, because he never used it.
Yeah.
Snail mails and personal interaction. I even had him on my campus at Messiah for several days doing a bunch of lectures. And he gave me a tour once of his former digs as the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, when he was retired. He took me back through and showed me that. We even crossed crossed over the Cams on a famous bridge together that was in his digs. But it, you know, this is someone I had always wanted to meet, and I admire Polkinghorne and what he wrote about science and faith. I don't necessarily agree with everything any more than I necessarily agree with Boyle on everything. But I think he's a modern Robert Boyle insofar as he tried to take the findings of the science of his day, evaluate them, and place them within his theology, within Christian theology. For Polkinghorne, the big three were creation, resurrection, and eschatology. He believed in creatio ex nihilo. He believed in the bodily resurrection of Jesus, especially the work of his friend, N.T. Wright. And he believed in the coming kingdom, a new heaven and earth, where we will be re-embodied in resurrected bodies. And Polkinghorne believed those things. And he was also a fellow of the Royal Society, a colleague, in fact, of Stephen Hawking in the same physics department at Cambridge. He's often criticized by people who read too little of Polkinghorne, frankly, and who don't see the context in which he places things. You know, he's not a conservative evangelical thinker, but in my view, he's a classical Orthodox theologian, placing modern science in that theological context for his readers. So it's to me is the most important personal type of thing that happened while I was working on Robert Boyle.
Yeah, and you had the courage, you had the awareness, and then the courage to go introduce yourself. That's a wonderful story, no doubt, something you'll never forget. I'm glad you were able to share that. Thanks for sharing that with us. That's good.
And thanks for letting me share things.
Absolutely. This has been a tremendous conversation. I've been thoroughly engaged and really excited to learn more about this. I've got just a million things I can go read, and I'm looking forward to following up in the future. Where might people find you online? I will put links in the episode description to perhaps some of your places online, but is there anything you'd like to suggest or anything you would like to introduce or encourage our listeners or viewers to follow up on?
If you want to explore some of my writings, there's a lot of them available at ResearchGate.
Yes.
Including hard copies. I mean PDF copies of a number of things. Some things I cannot put there in PDF version because, you know, I don't have any copyright. I don't own the copyrights. But quite a few stuff is there in one form or another. But on your website, could you post that CV I sent you?
Absolutely. And I'd be delighted to.
That would show people where they can find these things. And if people have access to a scholarly library, a college or university library, people who have that access and want that access will know what to do. If they want to read anything else that I've written. There's quite a few popular level pieces, though, that I've written that you can find there. I did many, many columns, probably close to 100 columns a number of years ago for BioLogos. A lot of them. There's even a long series on Boyle, illustrated series And then there's a lot of other series I did there too, according to the history of American religion and science, that people might find approachable and you know, get something from it if they go there and find those. I also have written for Christian History Magazine, and those are freely available on their own website. I list those. I can send you. I'd have to look at that version I sent you of my CV to see if they're listed.
Sure.
I think I did. If I didn't, I can send you another version. You can let me know about that.
We'll certainly post this. I'd love to. We'll post the CV. We'll post the link to ResearchGate, which is where I found the article that we were most talking about today, Robert Boyle, The Bible and Natural Philosophy, which was published in Religions, a great journal, and very thankful for that. Creative Commons license also by which they produce it. You can find that as well as many others on ResearchGate. This has been a tremendous conversation and really insightful. Thanks for joining me today, Ted. I really appreciate it.
Again, thanks again, Camden, for your interest in this. At this point in my life, I'm particularly keen to take ideas out of the ivory tower, if you will, and put them out and put them out into the streets. And so I'm happy, really happy that you've shown this interest in that work.
You got it. Taking it to the streets, just like the Doobie Brothers. We'll do it. So hopefully we'll get a bunch of people that are wanting to follow up, and you'll be able to get out there more and perhaps find some other venues as well. But you're always welcome back here. I do want to point people back to our website as well, reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, upcoming events, new publications. We do have some new books that are out recently. So if you haven't seen those, take a look at the website. And most of all, subscribe to the email newsletter, because that's the best way for you to stay in touch with everything that we have going on and be notified. If you're not subscribed to our podcast, you'll at least through the email be notified when we have new episodes such as this one with our guest today, Ted Davis, Edward B. Davis. Thank you so much, Ted. And thank you, everybody, for watching and listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.